This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Steve Cropper, was the guitarist on some of the great soul hits of the 60s, records by Carla and Rufus Thomas, Wilson Pickett, Sam and Dave, and Otis Redding.
I've been loving you too long to stop now.
This 1965 Otis Redding classic was also produced by Steve Cropper. Cropper was a producer, songwriter, and house guitarist for Stax Records, the independent record company that defined the Memphis soul sound in the 60s. During the past year, Cropper reunited with the Stax House Rhythm Section, Booker T and the MGs. They hope to record an album, and they'll be playing in New York this weekend at the Lone Star Roadhouse. Cropper has also been touring Europe with the band from the John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd film The Blues Brothers. The Blues Brothers band is a big draw in Europe, where they released a successful live album earlier this year. Steve Cropper moved to Memphis when he was 10, a city famous for its rhythm and blues.
It was a giant city. I came from a little town with about 100 people in it, and really was raised on a farm. So the whole thing was new to me. The school system was new, buses were new, and definitely music was new because I grew up kind of on the Grand Ole Opry and the kind of Louisiana Hayride kind of stuff.
Well, you know, what's really interesting about that is that you ended up playing mostly with black singers and playing in integrated bands.
Right.
How did you get exposed to black music after being used to Grand Ole Opry stuff?
Well, that was really the thing. When I got a chance to have my own radio and start turning the knobs, I found one night this on WDIA black spiritual music. I'd never heard it before, and it just blew me away, the feeling, the excitement of it, and that sort of thing. I grew up in the Church of Christ, which is, in those days, basically a cappella singing, and I was very used to religious music, and I liked it, but here was a new twist on it. It had a beat, and it was, you know, what we call funky now. And that was really, I think, the turning point in my interest in music. There was a music there that I really couldn't get enough of, and I just loved it.
When you started playing guitar, did you have a sense of where you could fit in musically into the kind of music that you liked most?
Well, I think so. Definitely was spiritual because it was a rhythm thing. It wasn't so much lead and all of that. I really wasn't all that interested in intricate kind of music from a classical standpoint or from a country fiddle and that sort of thing. I liked listening to it, but I didn't have any desire to get an instrument and try to copy that. But religious music I did, and then when I got to hear the blues and all that, it sort of all tied in. And that's kind of, I think, what my interests went to. You know, being a white guy in a white school, I listened to rock and roll, rockabilly, and that sort of stuff. But, you know, we were into Hank Ballard and the Midnighters, Ray Charles, James Brown. That's what we liked the most as kids growing up. That's what we danced to. And when I started playing guitar and put a band together, that is the music that we played, and the kids loved it. I mean, that's what they wanted to hear. And so we used to get booked everywhere. You know, they had a lot of CYO dances and stuff like that, and we used to get booked to play those. And they liked us because we played the kind of music they liked to dance to.
Now, you were saying that you saw your guitar playing as being largely like rhythmic, and I think that's what you stuck with.
Yeah, I can't shake it. I never really was a lead player. I never tried to be a lead player. I've been lucky enough to have played a few solos on some great artist records. But really, I'm a rhythm man, and my best forte, I think, is capturing the feel of a song during its inception in the studio. I think that's where I'm best. Even though people fly me in all over to play on their records and overdub, I think they would be better using me on the ground floor, you know, as a building block rather than as a cherry on the cake.
That's interesting, and also that they'd be able to work off of your rhythm while they were
performing. Yeah, they don't think of it in those terms because I don't either. They don't know me. They just know the aftermath of some of the things I've been lucky enough to be a part of. But I don't know what if it's a gift or it's because I had such a love for, like I said, spiritual music in the beginning, that I have this talent that just sort of comes with finding the right groove for a song when I'm in the studio with an artist. And that seems to be the thing that always seems to make it, whether we're working with Rod Stewart. You know, I did a lot of stuff with Rod and Tommy Dowd, and I did a lot of the original stuff with Ringo and stuff, you know, when he did his solo albums and all. And those were the songs that seemed to make it up the charts, the ones that I was there on the ground for, helping the rhythm with the drummer and stuff like that.
Guitarist Steve Cropper is my guest. You had your first hit with a band called The Marquise.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me about who the band was and how you made the record.
Well, originally, Charlie Freeman and I, we started playing guitar with each other, and we just sort of had fun, and he was taking lessons, and he'd go to his lesson, and I'd wait for him at his house for him to get back, and he'd teach me what he learned that day. So I was kind of cheating the system a little bit, but anyway, we just started playing different things. We did some Elvis songs and some rock and roll and stuff like that, and we had a friend who thought that we were good. Obviously, we probably were pretty lousy at the time, but we didn't know that. And he said, "I've got a friend who's a disc jockey. He said, I'd like to take you guys down there and let him hear you, you know, and we're just young guys." So anyway, he took us down to his radio show one night. The guy's name was Keith Sheriff. And we went down there, and he said, "Okay, what do you guys got?" You know, we told him we've got some songs and so forth. He said, "Well, I want to hear you." So he put us in a studio, the two of us, and opened up a mic. He said, "Now, you know, I'm doing my show now, but," he said, "I can hear you guys." And he said, "You just go ahead and do your thing, you know." So we started playing our stuff, you know, played a couple of songs, and he motioned for us to come in, and about that time the phone started lighting up, and they were wanting to know, who are those two guys that they just heard? And I'm going, what's this? And he said, "Well, I didn't tell y'all, but," he said, "I put you out on the air." So anyway, all these people were calling, wanting to know who we were, and so he told us, he was pretty famous for his sock hops, and he'd have these sock hops every Saturday night at the National Guard Army, and he said, "If you guys get a drummer," he said, "I'll put you on my sock hop." And so we searched the school and found a guy in the ninth grade who played drums, Terry Johnson. And that was the first band, and we were called the Royal Spades. And shortly after that, we added Duck Dunn on bass, and we got Charlie Axton on saxophone, and Wayne Jackson on trumpet, and Don Nix on baritone, and formed the group The Marquise. And we had written this song with Jerry Lee Smoochie Smith on keyboards, and wrote the instrumental last night. And I think they played it for Atlantic. Atlantic liked it. They pressed up a few copies and put it out on the radio, and lo and behold, it just took off like crazy. So that was our first success.
How old were you when you and the group The Marquise had the hit last night?
When the hit came out, I just graduated. It was the summer we graduated from high school. So I was, 19, 18?
Now, it wasn't long after that you became affiliated with Stax Records. You became the guitarist in the house rhythm section, you became a producer, you became a songwriter with
floor
with
sweeper.
Stax. Yeah,
right. Tape copier and editor.
How did you get affiliated with Stax?
Well, it started Charles Axton, the tenor player, and the funny story about Charles Axton.
He was the tenor player with The Marquise?
He was a tenor player with The Marquise. He was on the record last night and everything. He came to me and he said, "I hear you guys got a pretty good band." He said, "You know, I play saxophone. I'd like to be in your band." And I said, "Well, I'm not really interested. I don't think we're interested in adding horns to the group." And I said, "How long have you been playing?" You know, and he said, "Oh, I've been taking lessons for 3 months." And I'm going, "Oh yeah, great." You know, and somewhere in the conversation, he goes, "Oh, by the way, my mother owns a recording studio." And I said, "Can you show up for rehearsal on Saturday?" And that is a true story. Now I may stretch it a little bit, but that's an actual truth. And we went out. His uncle, Jim Stewart, the owner of Stax Records, had a little studio in his garage in Memphis, and we went out there and jammed around, and then they moved from his garage to a little place out in Brunswick, Tennessee, where they had the Satellite label, and we would go out there every weekend and play and all that. And of course, Jim Stewart said that we never had a chance, we'd never make it, but I think he just was being devil's advocate to just see if he could push us into something, and we kept trying. We cut a bunch of instrumentals, some crazy little things that never saw the light of day, and until the time that we came up with last night. But what happened was, Estelle Axton, I don't know if she saw any talent there or what she saw, but she liked me enough to keep me around, and she put me to work in her record shop. And I sold records. That's what I did. And I kept working on the weekends. I would kind of do a little A&Ring because people were always coming in. And on Saturdays, I would hold auditions because people were always bringing in songs and all that. And that's sort of how I got started, you know, in the A&R thing. And finally, Jim said, wait a minute. He said, you know, Steve's spending more time in the studio and he is in the record shop and whatever. And so they got together and decided that I would be start getting my salary from the record company rather than the record shop. And I started working, I guess, A&R full-time at that point.
Well, you, with the group Booker T and the MGs, had the hit of Green Onions, and I think this was a big hit, and it helped out Stax Records a lot. How did the four of you, Booker T, Al Jackson, Donald Duck Dunn, and yourself get to play together and become the house rhythm section?
Well, what it all stemmed from basically was there we were with all this great success doing the Dick Clark Show and everything as the Marquees, and we had this big hit record last night, and it was a lot of fun. And then all of a sudden it wasn't fun anymore. It became work and what you call a road burdened and that sort of thing, and seven of us or eight of us traveling in one car and trying to make all these shows. And I found out that I wasn't too happy with the road. And so what I really wanted to do was get back in the studio. I mean, I'd already knew that that's what I wanted to do. Anyway, that's what I did. I came back to Memphis. I went to work in the studio again. I helped put together the rhythm section. I found out I'd been playing with another band called the Club Handy Band, and we had done some sessions for Don Robey. I don't even remember which songs, but I played on the Five Blind Boys albums. I played on Al T&T Bragg's. I think there was some Bobby Blue Bland stuff that I played on. But I played with a lot of those musicians, and we were asking around to find out who was a real good keyboard player. We had used several, and they said, there's this kid, he's still in school, named Booker T. Jones, and he's incredible. And they had worked with him on a lot of other stuff and on stage as well. And so we got Booker over on a session, and everybody just fell in love with him.
Well, let me play some of Green Onions, and because we're only going to play an excerpt, I'm going to start this a little in because I want to get to your guitar solo in it. So this is Green Onions, Booker T and the MGs. Take a short break and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is guitarist Steve Cropper. He was one of the house producers and in the house rhythm section of Stax Records during the 1960s and part of the 70s. Cropper has co-written many classic songs, such as Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding and In the Midnight Hour with Wilson Pickett. And he's part of the band Booker T and the MGs and the Blues Brothers. I want to ask you about some of the now classic records that you played on. Some of these are songs that you co-wrote. You co-wrote Dock of the Bay with Otis Redding, and you produced the record as well, right?
Right, correct.
What was your collaboration with him like when it came to writing songs?
Well, of course, we wrote a lot of songs together. The inception of Dock of the Bay was really no different than any other one. Otis was one of those kind of guys who had 100 ideas, and he always had with him, anytime he came in to record, 10 or 15 different pretty good ideas, either intros or titles or whatever. And he had been in San Francisco doing the Fillmore. And the story that I got, he had rented a boathouse or stayed out at a boathouse or something. That's when he got the idea of watching the ships come in the bay there. And that's about all he had. I watched the ships come in, watch them roll away again, and sitting on the dock of the bay. And I just took that. We just sat down, and I just kind of learned the changes that he was kind of running over, and I finished the lyrics. And if you listen to songs that I collaborated with Otis, most of the lyrics are about him. Well, he never really... He might say the big O in a song or something like that, but Otis didn't really write about himself, but I did. Songs like Mr. Pitiful, Sad Song, Fa-Fa, they were all about Otis and Otis's life, and Dock of the Bay is exactly that. I left my home in Georgia, headed for the Frisco Bay. It was all about him going out to San Francisco to perform, and that's kind of the way I wrote with Otis. I wrote the bridge and stuff like that, and that's the way we collaborated. He trusted me. I always seemed to do the things that he liked, worked on songs that came out the way he wanted them. And I also worked on a lot of songs with Otis, arrangement-wise, and helped him put them together and all that, where I didn't, claim any writers or anything, because it wasn't necessary. Otis had most of it finished to begin with, and I just helped him do it. But a lot of these things where he had just bits and pieces, I would actually put them together, and we'd make whole songs out of them and go in the next day and record them. So we had a lot of fun together. Otis was a great guy to work with, and he was a great friend.
Well, let's listen to the record. This is Dock of the Bay.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes, watching the ships roll in, and then I'll watch them roll away again. Yeah, I'm sitting on the dock of the bay, watching the tide roll away. Sitting on the dock of the bay, wasting time. I left my home.
Was it your idea to have the ocean sound effects in on the record?
Yeah. Atlantic said they were a little too loud, but I stuck in there. I kept them in. I thought the birds in the ocean was great.
I want to ask you about another record. And this is also a song you co-wrote. You co-wrote this one with Wilson Pickett, and it's Midnight Hour.
Uh-huh.
This was, I think, for the first session that you played with Wilson Pickett.
Right, it was.
Tell me about writing the song with him.
Well, it's real simple. We knew that he was coming down, and, of course, my connection with the record shop. And I went up and found some stuff that he had sung on. Of course, he sang, with the Falcons, and he had sang some spiritual things. And it seemed like every time that he sang lead on something, when he got down to the fade-out, he would go, "Oh, wait till the midnight hour. Whoa, see my Jesus in the midnight hour." And all this, I said, that's the guy's ID. So I just took that right there and presented it to him with a little idea. He had a couple ideas. And what happened was that we picked him up at the airport. They dropped us off at the hotel. And Jerry Wexler and Jim Stewart went out to get something to eat and just talk business. And when they came back, I don't know, it was a couple hours later, we had In the Midnight Hour written and Don't Fight It. They said, "We're going to get out of here, let you guys keep going." And they left, and we wrote a thing called I'm Not Tired. And we went in the studio the next day, recorded all three songs, and all three songs were hits. Very lucky me, huh?
Well, let's hear In the Midnight Hour. Wilson Pickett in the Midnight Hour, co-written by my guest Steve Cropper, who's featured on guitar. You also did a lot of work playing behind Sam and Dave, and Sam and Dave were the inspiration for the Aykroyd and Belushi group, the Blues Brothers, and you played with them as well. What did you think of the Blues Brothers when they got started, or when you got started, or whatever? What did you think of... Did you think that it was a parody that was in bad taste at all? Like two white guys doing their parody of black singers. to white guys who probably fantasize about themselves sometimes of being being black singers. But what was your take on it?
Well, you know, they got a lot of bad rap on that, I think, initially. And a lot of people, for some reason, thought that John and Danny were kind of scoffing black musicians for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the case at all. And what I found out was really the contrary to all of that. They had such a love for that kind of music, for rhythm and blues and so forth. And I couldn't believe it. I went to John's house one day, and he showed me a collection of blues stuff that just blew me away. I'd never seen that big of a collection of blues music. Of course, being in Chicago, he had a lot of access to a lot of stuff that, of course, we never heard in Memphis and so forth. It never really, most of it didn't reach the record shop that I worked in. But you mentioned about Sam and Dave being their influence. That is something that really came about whenever they decided to put a band together and got Duck Dunn and myself involved in the group. Because they were from the show, you know, from the routine they did on the show, their concept of an album at that point was strictly doing nothing but blues kind of songs. And, you know, things by the Down Child Blues Band and you know, Delbert McClinton stuff and all those kind of things. And I felt, you know, I'd been in the business a long time, and I felt if they wanted me to contribute anything to this, I thought they should go a little bit more commercial. And so it was my suggestion, along with Duck Dunn and all, that we do something like Soul Man. And we later did Who's Making Love as well. But we talked them into doing that, and then they started asking about, well, how did Sam and Dave do, you know? And so we kind of started showing them some of the routines, like some of the dance things that Sam and Dave would do on stage. And they go, yeah, man, this can be fun. So that's something that was sort of a new ingredient put in the Blues Brothers act as we started making preparation to do a show.
The Blues Brothers obviously disbanded after Belushi died, but you're in a group now called the Blues Brothers. Who's in the group? I know you have a new record that I think was recently released in Europe. Is that right?
Right. Correct.
So what are the Blues Brothers now?
Well, I'll tell you what it is. It consists of six of the original members of the original Blues Brothers band, the one that did the concerts, the one that's you know, did the movie and everything. And everybody always asks, well, who does Jake and Elwood? Well, we don't have Jake and Elwood. We let the audience come as Jake and Elwood. And we have anywhere from 5,000 to 25,000 screaming Jake and Elwoods out there. I mean, Jimmy Buffett's got his parrot heads, and we got our Jake and Elwoods. And a lot of times we get them up on stage, and they get up and dance. You know, they have their hats and glasses on, and it's just a lot of fun. We have, from the Stax days, we have the original Mr. Knock on Wood, Eddie Floyd, singing with us, which is great. And it's really a lot of fun to be back with him after all these years. And we have a young blues singer named Larry Thurston out of St. Louis, Missouri, who handles all of the blues stuff, and he's terrific. So hopefully we're going to do something with both of those artists on an individual basis at some point in time, make a record with them. We're also going to make probably a studio record sometime next year, and maybe that will get released in the States. But we've been together doing this now for about 3 years and having a lot of fun in Europe. We got a lot of great audience over there, and it's been a lot of fun playing with these guys.
You've brought a copy with you of the new Blues Brothers band, so
right.
Why don't we go out with your new recording of Soul Man?
Very good.
Steve Cropper will perform in New York this weekend with Booker T and the MGs. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.